Imagine for a second that you are walking into a dark room. You reach out, your fingers find the wall, and you just flip a light switch.
Right, something you do every single day.
Exactly. It's a completely everyday action. You don't even think about it. But powering that single bulb, sending that electricity into your home, it actually requires this hidden high-stakes war happening right now, like this very second, inside massive power plants all over the world. A literal war against extreme heat and unimaginable pressure.
It really is. It's a battle of physics. I mean, it's comforting to think of power grids as just, wires and spinning generators. But at the heart of it, keeping the lights on is fundamentally a materials problem, specifically a microscopic materials problem.
And welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to bridge a gap that seems, well, almost impossible. We're going to connect the mind-bending, invisible world of quantum physics to the massive, groaning global infrastructure of steam power plants.
Go ahead the jump.
It is. And to figure this out, we're pulling from a really fascinating stack of research today. We've got everything from a pretty dense 2010 master's thesis on computational metallurgy, that's by Songyu Young, to complex crystallographic data by HKDH Padeshia, and even some classic textbook excerpts on how steel transforms at the atomic level.
Yeah, and we're going to see how tweaking just a few single atoms, literally just a few atoms in a block of steel, can prevent catastrophic explosions, keep entire cities powered, and even play a massive role in reducing global carbon emissions.
Which is wild to think about.
It's a perfect example of how the tiniest microscopic changes dictate the largest microscopic impacts.
So to understand why we are zooming all the way in on individual atoms, we first have to, understand the massive physical forces threatening these power plants. What exactly is the environment like inside one of these facilities?
Well, the engineering world is on this constant push for thermal efficiency.
Right.
A power plant basically boils water to make high-pressure steam.
Right.
And that steam turns a massive turbine. But to get more energy out of less fuel and, crucially, to reduce CO2 emissions, you have to run these plants at extreme temperatures. We are talking about operating steam temperatures of 600 to 600 to 650 degrees Celsius.
Which is incredibly hot, like red hot. That has to be approaching the melting point of some of the components.
Oh, it's absolutely pushing the physical limits of the steel. And at these temperatures, the steel isn't just sitting there solidly. It experiences something engineers call creep.
Creep. I mean, it even sounds sinister. What is it actually doing to the metal?
It's the invisible threat, really. Creep is a time-dependent, permanent deformation of a material under constant stress. When you subject steel to huge pressure and 600-degree heat for years at a time, it doesn't just hold its shape, it literally begins to flow.
It flows like a liquid.
Kind of. It deforms over time. And there are actually three distinct stages to this stretching process.
Okay, so if it's like, say, sleep putty, it doesn't just snap immediately. It must stretch first. How fast does this happen in a turbine?
In a well-designed plant, it takes decades. But the progression is always the same. First, you have primary creep. This is where the deformation starts.
Yeah.
But the metal actually experiences what's called strain hardening.
Strain hardening.
Right. The act of stretching makes the deformed material temporarily harder to stretch, so the rate of creep actually slows down initially.
Okay, so the metal fights back a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But then you enter secondary creep, which is the steady state stage. The internal hardening and the softening of the metal caused by the heat, they sort of balance each other out. So the material begins to stretch at a constant, steady, agonizingly slow rate.
And then the third stage.
Finally, you hit tertiary creep. This is the danger zone. The internal structure just gives up, the creep rate accelerates rapidly, the structural integrity fails, and the metal ruptures.
Man. So if I'm picturing that piece of silly putty hanging off the edge of a table at first, it stretches a little bit and resists. That's the primary stage. Then it just slowly, steadily flows downward in a long, thinning string. That's the secondary steady state. And eventually it thins out too much, the downward flow speeds up and it just snaps. That's the tertiary creep.
That is a remarkably accurate way to visualize the timeline. The steady state flow of the silly putty is exactly what engineers are desperately trying to control. They want to stretch out that secondary phase for as long as physically possible.
But wait, if power plants are designed to run for 30 or 40 years, how exactly do engineers prevent the silly putty snap when the steel is constantly baking at 600 degrees?
Well, because if that steady state secondary creep isn't strictly controlled, these power plants would fail prematurely. And a rupture in a high-pressure steam boiler isn't just a minor inconvenience. I mean, it leads to catastrophic accidents, explosions, and massive energy grid disruptions.
Yeah, that sounds terrifying.
So to stop the steel from flowing, engineers have to create microscopic internal roadblocks inside the metal itself.
They have to physically block the metal from sliding against itself.
Precisely. The history of creep-resistant steels has basically been this massive trial-and-error process of adding specific elements to create microscopic structures that stop that stretching. Over decades of experimentation, engineers developed alloys containing 9 to 12% chromium, along with bits of molybdenum and other trace elements.
And these chemical additions create what the sources call carbides.
Yes. Specifically, they form these tiny crystal precipitates known as M23C6 carbides.
M23C6, I mean, that sounds like a license plate. But the M just stands for a mix of metals, right? Like the chromium and iron you mentioned.
Exactly. It's a highly specific crystal structure made of 23 metal atoms and 6 carbon atoms. These carbides form inside the solid steel, particularly along the grain boundaries.
Grain boundaries? You mean the areas where different crystals of the metal meet?
Yeah, think of them like microscopic fault lines. A piece of steel isn't just one continuous perfect grid of atoms. It's made of millions of tiny microscopic crystals or grains packed together.
Oh, I see.
And the brooders between them are the grain boundaries. When the steel gets hot and experiences stress, those fault lines are where the sliding and the stretching happen first.
So the grains of metal literally slide past one another.
They try to. But the M23C6 carbides sit right on these fault lines and act as physical barricades. They pin the boundaries in place so the grains can't slide. Oh. They basically physically block the creep.
Well, that sounds brilliant. You just throw in some chromium and carbon, build some barricades on the fault lines, and problem solved.
Well, not quite, because there is a fatal flaw over the long term. Remember, this steel is sitting in a furnace at 600 degrees Celsius for 30 years. Over a long period of time at those extreme temperatures, these tiny barricades undergo a really destructive process called coarsening.
Coarsening, meaning they clump together.
Yeah, the fine, evenly distributed carbides start to absorb each other. The thermodynamics of the heat cause them to grow into larger, coarse clumps. And when they do that, two terrible things happen. First, they leave large gaps on the grain boundaries completely undefended, allowing the metal to start sliding. Second, these giant coarse lumps actually become nucleation sites.
Nucleation sites meaning birthplaces for cracks.
Yes. Because they are so large and hard compared to the surrounding metal, the stress concentrates around them, birthing microscopic voids and cracks. They become the very thing that triggers the rapid failure of the tertiary creep stage.
So it's like if I mix a perfectly fine powder of sugar into cookie dough to stiffen the whole mix, but when I bake it for a really long time, the fine sugar melts and clumps together into giant hard rocks inside the cookie.
Right.
Suddenly you have sections of dough with no sugar at all and giant hard lumps that ruin the structural integrity.
Close, but it's actually worse than that. In your dough, the sugar is just melting together. In the steel, the coarse clumps are actively cannibalizing the smaller ones. And for a long time, this was the great bottleneck in metallurgy. How do you keep the sugar from clumping? How do you keep the M23C6 carbides small and stubbornly stable over decades of heat?
And according to the sources, the magic bullet was boron.
Yep. Engineers discovered through intense physical experiments that sprinkling in tiny, almost trace amounts of boron remarkably increased the creep rupture strength. It massively delayed that deadly tertiary creep stage.
Just a tiny pinch of boron. But how does sprinkling in boron stop the clumping? Did it, like, build a different kind of barricade?
That was the mystery. They knew it worked, but they had absolutely no idea why. Later on, scientists used atom probe microscopy, which is this incredible technology that literally strips a material apart atom by atom to build a 3D map of its chemistry.
Wow.
Yeah, and this proved that the boron was hiding evenly distributed inside these M23C6 carbides. But the actual mechanism of why this prevented the clumping was completely unknown.
Wait, if they knew it was inside the carbide, couldn't they just look up the properties in a textbook?
They couldn't. M23C6 doesn't even show up on standard boron phase diagrams. Traditional experimental thermodynamics just hit a brick wall here. Yeah. You cannot just easily observe the thermodynamic energy states of a few boron atoms hiding inside a microscopic carbide crystal while it's baking at 650 degrees inside a spinning turbine. It is experimentally impossible to measure those forces directly.
So because traditional physical science hit a wall, Song Yu Young and the researchers at the Graduate Institute of Ferrous Technology had to go entirely virtual, they turned to computers.
And not just standard computers. They used massive supercomputers to perform something called a first principles calculation.
Here's where it gets really interesting. First principles. That means building it from the ground up, right?
Exactly.
So because we can't test this physically, we are mathematically simulating every single electron in the steel using pure quantum mechanics. It's like calculating how a cake will taste by solving math equations for the flour and eggs instead of actually baking it.
That is precisely what they did. A first principles approach uses zero experimental data. Nothing is measured in the lab. You don't plug in the melting point or the density. It relies solely on the fundamental laws of physics, specifically solving the Schrödinger equation for the many-body system of atoms.
The Schrödinger equation, the famous quantum mechanics equation that describes the wave function of a system. But isn't that incredibly complex for more than one or two atoms?
Oh, it is mathematically terrifying. Solving the Schrödinger equation for a complex crystal with dozens of interacting atoms and hundreds of electrons requires staggering computational power. So they use a framework called density functional theory, or DFT.
How does DFT simplify the terrifying math? Because tracking hundreds of electrons bouncing around sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It would be a nightmare. Instead of trying to track the exact position and path of every single individual electron simultaneously, which is functionally impossible, DFT looks at the overall density of the electron cloud. Think of it like a swarm of bees. Instead of tracking the flight path of every single bee, you just calculate the shape and density of the entire swarm as one single variable.
Okay, that makes it much more manageable. Just track the swarm.
Right. And to simplify it even further, they use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Because the nucleus of an atom is thousands of times heavier than an electron, it moves much, much slower. So the computer essentially freezes the heavy nuclei in place and just calculates how the fast-moving electron swarm behaves around those fixed points.
Freeze the heavy stuff, simulate the fast electron cloud.
Exactly. And to make sure the simulation was perfectly accurate, they employed a specific flavor of DFT called the FLAPW method. That stands for Full Potential Linearized Augmented Plane Wave.
Which means what, exactly?
It means they didn't take any mathematical shortcuts with the shape of the atoms. Electrons exist in different layers. You have the deep core electrons that stay tightly bound to the nucleus, and the outer valence electrons that actually do the chemical bonding and interacting.
Right, the ones on the outside.
This method fully simulated all of them. They recreated the crystal structure of the M23C6 carbide, which is incredibly complex geometry. It has 92 chromium atoms sitting in four different symmetrical arrangements and 24 carbon atoms.
Wait, time out. I need to push back on this. The sources mentioned they did all this math at absolute zero, zero Kelvin.
Yes, zero Kelvin and zero pressure.
But the whole problem we are trying to solve is extreme heat causing the metal to melt and stretch. Why on earth are they simulating it by freezing it to absolute zero? Doesn't that completely defeat the purpose of the experiment? How does a calculation done at a frozen absolute zero prove why a turbine won't explode at 600 degrees Celsius?
That is a very intuitive question. The reason you calculate it at absolute zero is to find the fundamental formation enthalpy of the structure. Enthalpy is essentially the thermodynamic energy baseline of the atomic structure.
The baseline energy.
Right. It tells us how much energy is required to form the structure or how much energy is released when it forms. It's the ultimate measure of thermodynamic stability.
Okay, but again, why does that matter for a hot boiler?
Well, think about it. If the atomic foundation is wildly unstable at absolute zero, heat will only rip it apart faster. But if a structure has a profoundly deep, stable formation enthalpy at absolute zero, it means it is deeply locked in place. You would need a massive amount of external heat energy to disrupt it. By finding the baseline at zero, they can prove exactly how resistant it will be to the 600 degrees of heat.
Ah, I get it now. So after doing all this intense quantum math, simulating the electron swarm at absolute zero, what did the supercomputer actually find? Did they crack the boron mystery?
They absolutely did. They first calculated the formation enthalpy of the standard chromium carbide,
right,
the one without boron, which we know clumps together over time, Cr23C6. The computer returned an enthalpy of negative 8.61 kilojoules per mole atom.
Negative 8.61.
Okay, then they ran the supercomputer simulation again. But this time, they virtually swapped out the carbon atoms for boron atoms. They created Cr23B6 inside the computer.
And the result?
The formation enthalpy plummeted. It dropped from negative 8.61 to negative 13.53 kilojoules per mole atom.
Wow. That is a massive drop. But for those of us who don't dream in thermodynamics, what does a more negative number actually mean physically?
In thermodynamics, that massive plummet is the mathematical equivalent of the carbide letting out a deep breath and settling perfectly into a permanently locked position.
So in the world of thermodynamics, a lower, more negative number means the atoms are happier and more relaxed, right?
What's fascinating here is that, yes, a lower, more negative formation enthalpy means the structure is significantly more thermodynamically stable. The math proved that boron literally stabilizes the carbide from the inside out.
So it actually is like finding a magical structural glue.
The mechanism is just beautiful. When boron is introduced, it physically changes the lattice parameter, the physical dimensions of the crystal grid. It actually expands the volume of the unit cell by about 4.4%.
Wait, it makes it bigger. Doesn't making it bigger make it more awkward to fit into the steel?
You would think so. But energetically, that expansion allows it to fit the atomic geometry around it much better. It lowers the internal energy of the entire system so much that the carbide loses its desire to change. Because it is so highly stable in its new boron-infused form, it deeply resists the thermodynamic urge to coarsen or clump together over decades of heat.
It just sits there, perfectly content.
Exactly. It stays as a fine, even barricade along the grain boundaries, pinning those microscopic fault lines in place. It perfectly explains the empirical data from the power plants. Boron delays the tertiary creep because it prevents the barricades from cannibalizing each other into those giant crack-forming lumps.
That is unbelievable. Pure quantum math, tracking electron density at absolute zero, predicting exactly why a physical turbine spinning for 30 years doesn't explode.
And the simulation was incredibly robust. They even tested the reverse. They tested what happens if you substitute too much iron into the carbide instead of chromium. When they simulated pure F23C6, the enthalpy was positive 3.66.
Positive, meaning it doesn't want to exist.
It means it is wildly unstable. It takes constant energy just to hold it together, which perfectly aligns with real-world observations that pure iron carbides of that specific structure simply don't naturally form. The first principles calculation predicted reality flawlessly.
Okay, so boron is the hero. The superstable boron-infused M23C6 carbide is exactly what we want, locking down the fault lines inside a power plant boiler. But as with everything in engineering, there's always a catch, right? Does this hyperstability cause problems anywhere else?
There's always a trade-off in material science. And this exact same thermodynamic stability, the fact that M23C6 deeply loves to form and loves to stay together, can cause massive dangerous problems in a totally different scenario. Specifically when you are simply trying to weld two pieces of this steel together.
Because welding involves extreme localized heat, right? You are melting the metal to fuse it.
Exactly. When you weld stainless steels or creep-resistant steels, you create what's called a heat-affected zone in the solid metal right next to the weld pool. The extreme heat causes M23C6 carbides to rapidly precipitate out of the solid steel, especially at those grain boundaries. Remember, thermodynamics absolutely wants this carbide to exist because it's so stable.
But I thought we wanted them on the grain boundaries. Why is that a bad thing during welding?
We want them formed properly, slowly, and evenly during a controlled manufacturing process. When they form rapidly and chaotically during welding, they act like incredibly greedy neighbors. To build that complex 23 metal atom crystal structure so quickly, it violently steals chromium from the surrounding steel matrix.
So if it steals all the chromium from the surrounding neighborhood to build its own house, doesn't that leave the rest of the steel completely defenseless against rust? Because chromium is the exact element that makes stainless steel stainless.
You have just described exactly what engineers call weld decay. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the microscopic areas right next to the grain boundaries become severely chromium depleted. They lose their protective passive layer. So while the carbide itself is super stable and strong, the surrounding depleted zone becomes incredibly susceptible to intense localized corrosion.
Wow.
A massive steel pipe might easily hold up to 600 degrees of internal steam pressure, but because of weld decay, it will rust straight through from the outside right along the microscopic line next to the weld seam.
That is a brutal irony. The very chemical reaction giving the steel its high temperature strength is the exact same reaction making it vulnerable to rotting away at the seams.
It's a constant balancing act for the engineers. You have to carefully control the heat input during welding to minimize that rapid precipitation. And the textbook excerpts highlight a really fascinating crystallographic quirk about how these greedy carbides form. Steel changes its internal crystal structure depending on how hot it is. When it's superheated, it enters what we call the austenite phase, where the iron atoms rearrange themselves into a different 3D grid.
The austenite phase, got it.
When M23C6 precipitates inside this hot austenite phase of steel, its lattice parameter, the physical size of its repeating 3D crystal cube, is almost exactly 3 times the size of the austenite's crystal cube.
Wait, exactly 3 times the size?
Almost perfectly.
Yeah.
Because of this bizarre geometric coincidence, when the carbide forms, it perfectly aligns its cube edges with the surrounding steel's structure. They call it a cube-cube orientation relationship. It nestles flawlessly into the existing atomic architecture.
So it's literally like Lego bricks. A 3x3 square Lego block fits perfectly onto a grid of 1x1 blocks, locking down all the pegs.
A perfect analogy. It clicks right into the existing matrix, which is part of why it can form so easily and stubbornly at those boundaries, for better or for worse.
Man, this has been a massive journey. Let's trace the path we just took. We started in the macro world. Massive power plant turbines, 600 degrees Celsius, fighting a desperate, decades-long battle against the slow, time-dependent stretching of high-temperature creep.
And we zoomed down into the microscopic grain boundaries of the metal, looking at the fine clumps of M23C6 carbides acting as fault line barricades to stop that stretching.
Right. And when we realized those barricades were cannibalizing each other over time, causing the steel to eventually snap, we had to go full quantum. We followed computational metallurgists out of the physical lab and into the supercomputer,
where they used the Schrödinger equation and density functional theory to track electron swarms at absolute zero, proving that dropping just a few boron atoms into the mix permanently drops the formation enthalpy, energetically locking the lattice in place and keeping those barricades incredibly strong.
Tweaking a few atoms to save an entire global power grid. It is incredible. But it leaves me with a thought that I want to pass on to you listening. Today, we explored how supercomputers used pure quantum math to accurately predict the real-world physical behavior of steel, simulating it frozen at absolute zero to definitively prove how it behaves at 600 degrees.
All without ever melting a single piece of physical metal in a laboratory.
So, if first principles calculations allow us to fundamentally solve material science purely through math, what else is out there? What other impossible engineering bottlenecks, perhaps the perfect lightweight shielding for deep space spacecraft or next-generation solid-state batteries that never catch fire, are sitting right now inside a computer, just waiting for the algorithms to calculate the perfect atomic recipe before a single physical prototype is ever built?
We are definitely entering an age where we can design the literal materials of the future on a screen, atom by atom.
It gives a whole new meaning to flipping that light switch on the wall.
That